If you haven't heard, we're doing it big on Thursday, October 3rd in Los Angeles. That's the date for the Trapital Summit. This is the first summit that Trapital is hosting, and this is going to be the place for the innovators, the builders, and the visionaries that are pushing music and entertainment forward. We have a curated lineup of some of the top leaders in the industry that are doing things big, and they're going to be joining us for fireside chat conversations. You'll hear from Issa Rae, Tunji Balogun from Def Jam, Troy Carter from Venice Music, Kakul Srivastava from Splice, Charisse Clark Suarez from Harborview Equity Partners, Denis Ladegiri from Believe, Elias Seaton from SoundCloud, and more. I am really excited about this, and the thing I'm really excited about is that we're doing things a little bit differently. We've all been to the conferences where there's so many people on stage, so many people that are at the panel. You want to hear from some of them a lot more than others, but no, we're keeping the bar high and we're having deep conversations and real conversations with the people that are actually making moves in this industry. So you can get your tickets now. Tickets are on sale now. You can click the link in our show notes that bring you directly to the website. And anyone listening to this episode can get a 10% discount. Use the code RUNCIE. That's my last name. That's RUNCIE. And get 10% off your ticket. This is going to be a dope event. I'm really excited about it. And I hope you are too. See you there. Hey, welcome to Trapital. I'm your host, Dan Runcie. This is your place to gain insights on the business that shapes music, media, and culture. We dive deep into the companies and moguls who start the trends that shape the rest of the business world. There is no one in the entertainment world that moves quite like 50 Cent. The man turned trolling into a profession, and he's been doing it with his colleagues, friends, foes, and partners for nearly 30 years now, dating back to his songs like 1999's How to Rob, where he took stray shots at Jay-Z and countless other hip-hop and R&B artists, or the biggest album of 50's career, Get Rich or Die Tryin', that includes several diss tracks towards Ja Rule and the entire murdering camp. But we also see it in some of the more recent posts as well on 50's Instagram page, where he'll call out his business partners at Starz over the power franchise that they work on together. The man toes that line of shock value, and he's found a way to make it work for him, and that's why he's a true one of one. And in today's episode, we break it down. We talk about some of those ups and downs of his early music years, what it was like to get dropped by the record label, him getting shot 9 times, the massive success that he had with Shady, Aftermath, and Interscope, with Eminem and Dr. Dre, the brand deals like Vitamin Water, Reebok, boxing promotion, and multimedia, and a whole lot more. And to break it all down, I'm joined by Zach O'Malley Greenberg, friend of the pod. He also interviewed 50 Cent and has had songs by 50 that were referencing Zach's work. So he's a perfect person to break it down with on our second installment of One of Ones. Hope you enjoy this one. Let's dive in. All right, we're here today to talk about a true one of one, someone that has came through music and hip hop. And I don't think there's anyone quite like him. Today, we're going to talk about 50 Cent, and I'm joined by my guy, Zach O'Malley Greenberg. Welcome back, man.
Great to be here, as always.
You've interviewed 50 Cent. You've done profiles on him for Forbes. So tell us about your experience with him.
The first time I interviewed him, it was probably my first really big interview with Forbes back in maybe 2008. And the prior year, we had put him on the cover before I got there, like around the time of the Vitamin Water deal, which we'll get into. But Forbes wanted to do like a magazine spread that would show him like in his element with his entourage. And we went in there, no frills. It was 50, Chris Lighty, who was his manager at the time, a lawyer, a brand manager, and a publicist around a boardroom table. He was this consummate showman. He was Machiavellian, above all. He could adapt to whatever setting he was in, and he would turn things up and down based on whether he was in the boardroom or on stage in order to get the desired result. That's the kind of theme you could see throughout his entire career.
And in 2008, this is after Curtis, this is after The Massacre, after Get Rich or Die Tryin'. Even though from a commercial perspective, he had already had that moment of, oh, hip hop may be going a slightly different place. From a business perspective, he was arguably bigger than ever, just considering how many moves that he was making, him getting in front of Forbes. That's a theme that I think has stuck with him his entire life, looking at him from his early days and all the way up to now being an almost 50-year-old man.
Yeah, and I remember asking him about the vitamin water deal. But I said, how did that feel? And he said, a lot of people are talking about the fact that I took home $100 million. But I was focused on the fact that $4 billion plus was made in the deal. I think that kind of gives you a sense of his mindset.
And with that, we should chat a little bit about his early years. As he said in many different songs, he grew up Southside, Jamaica, Queens, born 1975. He is growing up in the middle of the crack epidemic in the 80s, and he's very much a product of that environment. And he's also the product of broken home as well. His father wasn't around. His mother died when he was 8 years old. He ends up being raised by his grandparents. And there were definitely some tough years there. His grandparents thought that he was doing extracurricular activities after school. No, he's selling crack. He's selling heroin. He went to school once and the metal detector went off because he had guns on him. He later got arrested for having crack, heroin, and a pistol on him. At 19 years old, this is 1994, he ends up being sentenced to 3 to 9 years in prison, but he instead opts for this boot camp that he does, which is in upstate New York. He goes there for 9 months, and that was in many ways, I don't want to say a turning point because 50 Cent never truly changed, but this sets the foundation for him thinking about, okay, what is my life and what does my career look like after this?
I think the whole mythology he built around going away and going to this boot camp as a turning point, whether it really was or not, or whether he really did change, it's all about the story. And 50 Cent has always been a master storyteller.
And that's something that we've seen with the most successful business leaders. Your ability to communicate is what sets you apart. We've talked about this with Jay-Z. Your ability to tell a story and captivate an audience is what can set you ahead. And for him, there's also an image part of this too, because you fast forward to 1997, drug dealer through and through, but he's driving Benzes around. He's dressed in extravagant ways. And he actually has the story where he talks about meeting Jam Master Jay for the first time. And this was around the time when he was rapping, making different songs with friends. He says, quote, there was a club called Bentley's in New York, and I met him on his way at the club. At the time, I had a Kenny Anderson Nets jersey on. And at this point, he thought I was Kenny because I pulled up in a Benz. I was doing good on the street side, but that don't last long. I'm already looking at finding something else that I can do. And when he was telling me this stuff doing with his label, I really wanted to work.
End quote.
This was 50's first time working with someone like Jam Master Jay, of course, from Run DMC. So he knew the importance of having cosigns early and having the relationships early. And this is something that we saw continue out with him through his career.
Yeah, absolutely. The Queens connection, right? Jam Master Jay, of course, Run DMC. Go back to Queens, LL Cool J, but 50 Cent's from Queens, Nas is from Queens. And I think it's funny how nationally and internationally, Brooklyn and Harlem are probably better known when it comes to hip hop, but Queens really gave us just as many legends, right? When you do the overall tally, maybe we should do a formal tally and add it all up.
Right, even some of the more recent folks, Eve over at Dreamville, Griselda, Queens gets the money. Jam Master Jay, though, he mentioned a few things that he learned from him in terms of song structure and how to put together choruses. 50 Cent is now applying that himself, and he even talks about how his song, P.I.M.P., came from what he learned from Jam Master Jay. The unique thing was 50 Cent never ended up formally signing to Jam Master Jay Productions. 50 Cent's goal was a major record label deal. He saw what Jam Master Jay was doing as a bit of a stepping stone. So at this point, lines up working with Trackmasters, making music on a regular basis. He said at one point he made 36 songs in 18 days, putting in 2 songs a day. And his thought was, I have access to some of the best producers and productions team out there. Let me get my work in. Let me put in everything that I need to do. And that's ultimately what sets him up to be able to sign a record deal in 1999. With Columbia Records. And this is 50's first time signing with a major record label.
I think people forget about this part of his career. It's almost like a Star Wars trajectory. Jam Master Jay is like the Obi-Wan Kenobi to his Luke Skywalker. Dr. Dre, who would be the Master Yoda character. Maybe Eminem is Han Solo or something. But there were like multiple different mentors. It was a bit of a slog before. It wasn't like he just was anointed and arrived and just immediately became this huge thing.
He definitely had his ups and downs on that journey. The Columbia time is notable for a few reasons. So one, Steve Stout was an executive at Columbia at the time. That was one of the folks that had signed him and gotten to know him early on. But then he releases a few songs on the first project that they released through Columbia, which is The Power of a Dollar. And on that record, there's a song with Destiny's Child, but there's also a song called How to Rob, where he's literally calling out every popular artist at the time, talking about how he's going to rob them, how he's going to take their jewelry. He doesn't care. And he has this funny quote here that he shared last year in a BT interview where he says, quote, "That was desperation. I was following Biggie and Tupac's situation, and it was very rare to hear artists just say what they feel about each other," he explains years later. "They would subliminally say things to each other on records, but never actually mention the person while they're actually doing it." So this is 50 Cent saying, no, I'm going to mention you by name. None of this cryptic stuff that you even hear now in diss records. He was calling it out there, and he even gets a response from Jay-Z. He records that song, It's Hot. He has that line in the song, "I'm about a dollar, what the fuck is 50 cents?
That line about putting bullets through Jay-Z's Bentley door and eliciting that reaction from Jay. 50 may have said that he was doing it in desperation. He just didn't know what else to do. And maybe it was an accident, but that feels like vintage 50 to me, right? It is strategic. If you go for the king and the king responds, then you are elevated to royal status. And that's exactly what happened. And I think that's been done at other points in hip hop and world history between leaders. And if somebody who's on a lower level is engaging with somebody on a higher level and that person on the higher level takes the bait, you know, that's really good for the person on the lower level. That was the first time I'd heard of 50 Cent when Jay mentioned him. And that free publicity that he got, whether it was intentional or not, it really informed how he moved in the future.
So it seemed like things were going well, but then May 2000, he gets shot 9 times outside of his grandmother's house. And this changes a lot for him for 2 reasons. One, he soon gets dropped by his record label, Columbia, when he was still recovering from the gunshot wounds. But on the other side, him getting shot 9 times adds to the allure of 50 Cent, adds to the brand of 50 Cent, and especially in this post-Tupac era where people are looking for who is going to be the next top kingpin in rap, what does that formula look like? You see someone like DMX that smoothly went into that lane, and DMX obviously had a very successful run from 1998 to 2003. However, there was still space for someone else to come through. So if you're thinking about what does the prototypical successful rapper that's not Eminem look like in the early 2000s, it's literally 50 Cent. And then now he has this unfortunate, tragic incident that happens to him, but it builds to that alert. The amount of times that we heard growing up, oh, he got shot 9 times. He got shot 9 times. It became a tagline for him. And it's something that did continue to benefit him in a lot of ways as his career went on.
Yeah, and I think it's also important to think about the climate in hip hop, and particularly on the label level at the time. There was definitely a feeling of corporate America being afraid of hip hop and violence. And so the sort of specter of violence that surrounded 50 Cent after that shooting scared Columbia off. Once again, he did an amazing spin job, right? Like taking this tragedy and turning it into, like you say, a tagline to give him that extra legendary vibe and an air of like invincibility. I got shot 9 times and so nothing can stop me. One of the shots went into his mouth area and it changed the way he spoke. It gave him this kind of Don Corleone like slurring sound, made him sound more interesting. I don't know if that's true or not, but that's it's part of the legend.
I've heard that as well. And I remember hearing that and going back and listening to Power of a Dollar compared to some of the mixtapes. And part of me feels like there was a difference. I'm wondering, is part of that just because now someone told me this and now I'm actually listening to it? Yeah. But I'm glad you mentioned the point about corporate America and just how Columbia was looking at things at the time, because as you and I talked about in our Interscope episode, there was a lot of concern about having gangster rap and how that was perceived. And then even in the late 90s, a lot of these artists couldn't get the touring deals or couldn't get their promoters to buy in because they thought it was unsafe. It wasn't that long after the Hard Knock Life tour and they had to go through all these extreme measures just to prove that, hey, rap can do an arena tour without adding this or this.
In the late 90s, early 2000s, there were also a lot of sort of corporate musical chairs games occurring with mergers and acquisitions. A record label is about to get bought up by a larger parent company, or the parent company of the record label is about to get bought up by some other bigger company. And the idea of having violence or some kind of PR liability could imperil one of these mega deals. And so it was very easy to kick off individual artists that might be interfering with that larger game plan.
Great point, especially when that artist hasn't proven themselves yet to be a massive commercial success. It was easy to cut bait there. As we know, 50 Cent, one of one, what does he do at this point? He rolls up his sleeves and he continues to put music out, not the traditional way, but he starts releasing these mixtapes. And this is when he goes on this pretty epic run in 2002. And mixtapes were around for sure before this, but this in a lot of ways started the modern mixtape run, where he has these four that he releases. 50 Cent is the Future, No Mercy, No Fear, Guess Who's Back, and God's Plan. This is where we start to hear those early collaborations with Lloyd Banks and Tony Yayo. And there's a few things that stuck out that now seem commonplace with mixtapes. One, he was taking beats from other artists and rapping on them himself. Of course, this now seems like a standard thing, but that really wasn't what people did. People were scared about getting sued. People thought that the labels were going to come after them. And this is the thing about 50. The guy does not care about things. He's willing to toe these lines. This is what we're talking about. And he's also giving you album quality bars. I think about songs like Bad News that I think easily could have been songs on a studio album. And then this is also a mixtape that is truly coming from one artist. And he's working with DJ Who Kid, saw himself as a distributor to put these things out. So I just want to share a quick quote here where he says, quote, like I said, I'm the distributor. Instead of me, I created bootlegs anywhere that they sold drugs, like a corner. I would go to the bodega and be like, I want to leave 20 50 Cent tapes here, because the whole drug culture is connected with 50 Cent. They love his music. So I'm like, if these guys are coming here to buy drugs, like weed, getting their nickel bags and shit, then there's a tape on the window. Hey, you get a tape. I'll get a bag of chips, a turkey sandwich, and a G-Unit mixtape. And that was the vibe of the way things were. And I do think that worked in his favor tremendously, just in terms of getting the word out. This is guerrilla marketing, doing things aggressively and getting the buzz from the streets, which is what really resonated with him, even when the majors weren't looking at him at that particular point.
Yeah, it's grassroots retail politics. It's the senatorial candidate going to the diner and winning people over one person at a time. Nobody did it better than 50 did in those days.
It was impressive to see what sparked after this as well, where DJ Drama look at specifically what Who Kid and 50 Cent were doing and then run that same strategy back in the South with Jeezy and Lil Wayne. But I don't think it's a coincidence that two of the biggest albums of the 2000s in hip hop, Get Rich or Die Tryin' and The Carter 3, were preceded by these epic mixtape runs that built anticipation. Even while piracy and album leaks was really wrecking the industry, they were going about things a different way and still having these massive commercial successes when it came time to release them.
Yeah, and also it's what caught the ear of Eminem, which gave 50 his biggest break.
Eminem here is the mixtape we talked about, Guess Who's Back, plays it for Dre, and then they end up signing him, and the first single that they end up releasing was Wangsta. And this was fall 2002, and the song got tons of radio play. 50 Cent also had gotten on the 8 Mile soundtrack, which came out that year. Now you have the cosign of the most commercially successful rapper and the hip-hop legend working together. The Shady, Aftermath, Interscope trifecta coming together. You can't ask for much more.
No, absolutely. Things unfolded from there. Dre and Jimmy and Eminem ended up flying 50 out to LA. They signed this big deal. He gets this $1 million advance. But I think critically, 50 goes out and he ends up spending the first $300,000 of that $1 million advance securing trademarks for G-Unit and 50 Cent and so forth. He was thinking long-term in terms of the business scenario, not just the music.
We had Yayo and Young Buck was already coming through in the folds. We knew that the album was coming out. There was so much demand for the album that the traditional retailers were selling Guess Who's Back, the mixtape, at Media Play, Sam Goody's. It led to the release of In the Club, in early 2003, which came out a couple of weeks before the album came out. It has that epic music video with Dr. Dre and Eminem in there, 50 Cent in the lab. They're working on this specimen. He's upside down in the music video. It speaks to what we're saying, right? How do you build the prototypical superstar for the 2003 era? And this album, when it came out, Get Rich or Die Trying, was literally an earthquake of momentum that it had. I think it's up there for me with Doggy Style for Snoop Dogg in terms of the most anticipated debuts that we've seen from a hip-hop artist in terms of just how many people were excited to hear what's next.
Forget debuts. I don't think Jay-Z's like peak moment was ever that hot. Jay-Z, he maintains a 95 to 98, but 50 Cent for a minute there was like 110.
I think you're right. The running joke about this, someone tried to say that Jay-Z was the Karl Malone of hip-hop. That's a bit extreme to prove that point because Karl Malone never won a title. However, I get what they were saying. And if we're talking about all-time years or runs, I do think that 50 Cent's 2003 was higher than what we probably see. Other ones that come to mind, Eminem in 2002 with how big the Eminem show was, and then Lose Yourself in the 8 Mile movie coming out that year. That was pretty big. Even more recently, Drake in 2015, the two mixtapes that he had put out on Apple to the Meek Mill diss, Hotline Bling.
Yeah, peak DMX probably.
Oh yeah, peak DMX too, especially with the two albums that came out in 98 and then there was X in 99. Yeah. I guess you can make a case for Snoop just with The Chronic at the end of 92 and then Doggy Style after that. But yeah, it's a short list.
And frankly, 50 hasn't sustained that level. Obviously, he wasn't a one-hit wonder. He didn't fall off the map. He just couldn't sustain that heat for too long. But man, it was quite a peak.
It's a moment that is hard to forget. And to quantify some of this here, sold 872,000 copies in its first week in the U.S. And that's also despite the album leaking on the internet several weeks before that. And also copies by the end of 2003 is the best-selling album of that year in the U.S., according to Billboard. There's the song Many Men, where he literally names the person that he believes shot him 9 times. Songs like Back Down, Call Out Ja Rule. There are so many other hits besides just In the Club that reach the top of the charts. Even a song like 21 Questions, where Dr. Dre famously didn't want him to release that song because he felt that you don't need a song that's this commercially targeted, but 50 wanted to do it anyway, and Dre was like, okay, and it ended up still being one of the more successful hits from the album. A true classic. One of the things that was frustrating to 50 at the time was when it came to the critical acclaim, this album did not win any Grammys. I want to share with you the albums that were nominated for Album of the Year. Speakerbox Love Below by Outkast had one Album of the Year. Also nominated was Missy Elliott, Under Construction, Justin Timberlake, Justified, Evanescence, Fallen, and The White Stripes, The Elephants. These were all contemporary artists that were pretty big in 2003, but 50 Cent felt like his album pushed a few too many boundaries, and he felt like that was part of the reason that he didn't get the love there. It was nominated for Best Rap Album. These were the other nominees. So Speakerbox Love Below won. Under Construction by Missy Elliott was nominated. Get Rich or Die Trying, of course. Jay-Z's The Blueprint 2, Gift and the Curse, and The Roots, Phrenology. Those were the nominees.
Yeah, and I think it goes back again to the fear of violence and trying to move away from that. Every interlude, there was like a bunch of gunshots. It was not a tame album. He wasn't really apologizing to anybody or trying to appeal to the Grammy voters. So also interesting, Dre only produced a couple of songs on that album. We think of it as, oh, Dre produced the whole thing. But there are a lot of them that he's not listed as a producer on. Patiently Waiting and Many Men were both produced by Eminem. Obviously, Dre produced In the Club. What was the other big one? If I Can't Do It?
Yeah, If I Can't. That was a Dre track.
But P.I.M.P. I don't think was Dre. And I don't think 21 Questions was Dre or Eminem.
This really set off such a fascinating run for 50 Cent. He used the album to put on for the rest of his crew. And he has the G-Unit album that comes out later that year, Beg for Mercy, actually comes out the same day as Jay-Z's The Black Album. Huge songs on that album too, like Stunt 101, I Want to Get to Know Ya. When we talk about really taking over 2003, this is what we're talking about. This is where we see this 50 Cent and Ja Rule beef truly go to another level. There was an interesting episode of Club Shay, the show that Shannon Sharp does, because he had Steve Stout as a guest, and he asked Steve Stout, what was the origin of the 50 Cent and Ja Rule beef? And Steve gave a pretty thorough explanation talking about some of the neighborhood beef that they had back in the day in Queens and how 50 felt like Ja Rule came from a Jehovah's Witness family, was presenting to be more than he actually was, and there must have been a chain snatching or something like that that had happened, but how all of that built up to the issues that they ended up having with each other. But I do think the impact and the decline of what we saw happen for Ja Rule's career and speaks to the monoculture nature of hip-hop, especially in 2003. We talked about it earlier with Power of a Dollar, him calling out Jay-Z. Now he calls out Ja Rule, Fat Joe, Cam'ron, Jadakiss. The list goes on. 50 Cent probably came out the better person in a lot of those. Bar for bar, I think Jadakiss probably got him on checkmate, but this is 50. The guy just continues to keep going.
Who are you going to go after that's going to raise your profile more? The options were Jay-Z, been there, done that, like Eminem, who's his buddy, Dre. So he had to punch down a little bit. If you're in the news, you're having a beef, it's just like fuel for the fire. And so he just kept these things going, and it kept his name out. And even as the musical output was declining, or at least wasn't as good as Get Rich or Die Trying, I've lost track, honestly, of all the beefs that he's had over the years. And at some point, it became too hard to follow.
Let's take a break for our chart metric stat of the week. On July 24th, Jay-Z and Alicia Keys' song Empire State of Mind achieved diamond certification from the RIAA. The song has well over 1 billion streams on Spotify. It topped the Billboard Hot 100 for 5 weeks and is arguably the biggest hit of Jay-Z's career. I know he has a few other songs on Spotify that have more streams, but this is the one that was on his album. It's one of his signature hits. May not be my favorite Jay-Z song, but it's the one that you're probably most likely to hear on the radio. Let's get back to the episode. This also follows the Interscope formula that you and I talked about when we recorded that episode as well. Interscope was known for its shock value with the artists that released on the record label. When we talked about Dr. Dre, look at The Chronic. They made a music video and song all about Fuck With Dre Day. They make fun of Eazy-E, the entire music video. You look at any of the Interscope stuff that Eminem did in the Slim Shady or the Marshall Mathers LP days, he's making fun of all the other artists on TRL, like the Backstreet Boys and NSYNC, Christina Aguilera, all of that. And now 50 Cent's doing the same thing with Ja Rule and Murder, Inc. and everyone there. This is what they do.
Yeah, absolutely. Learn from the best. It makes a ton of sense.
And then with that, 50 Cent then goes into this moment where I think around like 2004, 2005, he almost gets in that blank check mode that, let's say, a film director can get in, where you are white hot. We will literally give you whatever you want. There's the Reebok sneakers, which we'll talk about, and the deal with G-Unit. There's the movie, which we should probably also talk briefly about, but there's also the video games. There's also The Massacre, which sold even more, at least in its first week, than the Get Rich or Die Trying album did. Some of those things hit more than others, but this is what happens when you're hotter than ever. You have carte blanche to do what you want in music and entertainment.
He and Jay patched up by the summer of 2003. They both put out these Reebok shoes. This was a reaction by Reebok to not getting LeBron, who went and signed with Nike. And so Jay-Z and 50 Cent were on this co-headlining tour for the summer and shilling their sneakers at the same time together. It just speaks to how big 50 was at that point. Jay and 50 were really the first non-athletes to have that kind of a deal, and I think that really means a lot.
Yeah, definitely. And they were really popular despite how bland they looked. I do think the G-Units looked cooler than the S-Dots did, a modern Jordan 5, but still, yeah. I think there was some left to be desired. And then the movie, did you watch that biopic, Get Rich or Die Trying?
I loved it. I thought it was, I saw it in Yonkers on like opening night with a bunch of friends, and it was electric, the atmosphere. Oh my God. And I thought he did a really great job in it. I thought probably 8 Mile and Get Rich or Die Trying are two of the better music biopics. But like the fact that they both acted in their own biopics, very impressive. I thought he did a great job.
I was very entertained by it. I was happy that it was out. I wish it was as good as 8 Mile.
Oh, I mean, 8 Mile's better. Like, yeah, for sure. But I don't know. Maybe it was like the atmosphere and the movie theater, but it felt like a live event. I don't know. It was I thought it was a really fun watch.
Yeah.
But it spawned all these other things, like the video game, and I don't think there was an 8 Mile video game.
No, true. There wasn't an 8 Mile video game. I did see Get Rich or Die Trying in theaters. I think I just got the DVD when 8 Mile came out, but yeah, it was definitely a moment. We should talk about The Massacre, because that was also released at this moment where there were a few hits they tried to make work. Piggy Bank, I don't think that song necessarily clicked as much. They had Disco Inferno, which I do think was a good song, a club hit. Candy Shop, I always felt like was just okay.
Candy Shop was big. But yeah, that was a big hit, though.
No? It was big, though. You're right. Yeah, it went to number one. I think from a commercial perspective, it definitely doesn't have like the shelf life of In the Club, but it was huge. You heard it on the radio literally all the time. And I think at this point, he started doing more with Game as well. So Game has his documentary album, which is great, a classic, and 50 Cent on his biggest songs as well. Hate It or Love It, How We Do, West Side Stories. In the same time frame is when he starts thinking more about his branding. He's working a lot with his manager, Chris Lighty, and this is where the origins of his Vitamin Water deal come from. And I know you and I have talked about this one at length when we did our most influential and revolutionary list of hip-hop deals. We ranked it in our top three for a good reason, but we should talk about it a little bit here more as well.
Yeah, absolutely. This, again, goes back to Queens, right? Vitamin Water, that was a Queens-based company. And I remember in reporting my book, Three Kings, I did some research on this, and they wanted to team up with either 50 or Jay because they were New York guys. Jay wanted too much money, but 50 was basically willing to bet on himself and take a very small amount of cash and a larger amount of equity to make this deal happen. He got his own Vitamin Water brand, Formula 50. It was authentic. 50 Cent was all about the muscles and the working out, and it made so much sense. And then he really dove in, and with the commercials, there's that great commercial with him, and he goes into conduct an orchestra. And they're like, are you ready, prepared to do this? And he's like, yeah, and he drinks vitamin water. And he really went for it and in a really credible way because he had skin in the game. He saw how much this could be worth for him. And then Coca-Cola came and bought Glasso. And that's how 50 ended up walking away with $100 million. I've seen that number. People have said that it was $400 million. Some people have said it was $40 million. I've talked to the people who did it. And it seems that $100 million is correct. But after taxes, almost half of it is probably gone. But still, that's just an immense payday. It was the biggest deal to that point that any hip-hop act had ever done. And it really provided a blueprint, right? I mean, who was taking equity on that level? Like a star who was that hot when they could be getting multi-million dollar endorsement deals, who was betting on themselves like that? He inspired other celebrities to do the same because like 8 years later, I was writing this cover story for Forbes about Ashton Kutcher. And I said, what inspired you to invest in startups? And he said, 50 Cent. He said that 50 Cent vitamin water deal. I remember seeing it. And I was getting some Kodak photo endorsement deal, or they're paying me cash. And I look over, oh man, this is the way to do it. You get paid in equity and the upside is so much greater. And so he inspired Ashton Kutcher to become a VC. And then Ashton Kutcher inspired basically every celebrity to become a VC or an angel investor. That cannot be understated how important that deal was, not just for hip hop, but for entertainment, for entertainers, for anybody with any level of celebrity, the model for how long-term generational wealth could be created.
He has such a good eye for this stuff. 50 Cent flipped it where he's like, oh, I see in the store that they're selling store brand bottled water next to Poland Spring, and Poland Spring costs however much more. That's all branding. How can I use my brand knowing the influence of that? People weren't thinking that way in the mid-2000s, especially celebrity investors. The stories you heard back then were a bit more like the Shaq thing, where Shaq's like, oh, I was in an elevator and I heard two guys talking about Google, so I decided to invest. Obviously brilliant, worked out well for him, but that could also lead to plenty of dumb investments as well.
Absolutely. And it was around this time that he put out the Forbes 1-2-3 I Get Money remix. And I just remember this. I had put out the first list ever of the top earning rappers in the world that I worked on at Forbes. I was reporting some of their story out in New Mexico. On the radio comes this song, Forbes, 1-2-3, I Get Money. And 50's rapping about Forbes, and Jay and Puff are on there, like shouting out Forbes.com. I got back to New York and they're like, this hip hop thing. you should keep following that. That was what gave my career its start in covering the business of entertainment. Having the three top earning rappers of the year make a song about a story you wrote will usually do that. It was also, in a way, it marked the beginning of this mainstream like business media fascination with hip hop in a sustainable way, not just as a novelty. It's like, this is a real business. This is something that is here to stay.
And for them, it made perfect sense because there's so many things about succeeding in hip hop that line up with the mainstreamness of succeeding in business as well. We talked about the storytelling and communication skills, but there's also the competitiveness and people wanting to be competitive of how high are you on the list? And if someone was only 10th on the list, then it wouldn't have made sense, right? You couldn't do like a 1-2-5 list. It had to be these three people at this particular time. So it's really unique there.
You actually had a referee, right? Instead of there were beefs and people would argue about who won or who lost, but you could talk about how you made so much money and you made so much more money than anybody else. But here we were saying, no, actually, 50 Cent made more than Ja Rule and that's that. And there was you could go to the tape. You could have your receipts. And I think that was a fun development.
And this is the same year that 50 went head to head with Kanye West for 50 Cent's album, Curtis, Kanye West album, Graduation. Both come out on September 11th, 2007. And they turned this into a competitive event too. And in many ways, felt like it was a bit of a changing of the guard moment from Kanye being the backpack rapper, always seeing himself as the outsider trying to fit in, 50 Cent being the persona of gangster rap for most of the 2000s up to that point. And Graduation sells considerably more, but 50 Cent's Curtis album still sells a ton too. And there's still popular songs from that album that made the rounds as well. That album may not have been as big as The Massacre or Get Rich or Die Trying, but it has I Get Money. It has AO Technology. There was still commercial success to be left in that tank. And I think there's other artists who could have went through that moment and it could have been like, oh man, I didn't win, especially when I said I was never going to rap again if I didn't win. But 50 Right. Cent was able to just use it more to his advantage, even though he didn't win and even though it was clear that rap was heading in a different direction.
Yeah, and I remember at the time interviewing him and he was continuing to spin things in a different direction. So it wasn't focused on losing that battle. It was about what he was doing with all this money that he was making. And he was telling me how he had it with Goldman and Morgan Stanley. And then he was exploring these ventures. It's like he said he had gone to South Africa with Patrice Motsepe. He was a billionaire over there and had gone thousands of feet deep into a platinum mine. And they had come up with this idea to make 50 Cent branded platinum jewelry. That just goes to show where his mind was at. And certainly, again, the chameleon thing. He's talking to this Forbes writer. He's talking about a billionaire diamond platinum mining guy. Like, he knows his audience.
And this is also an interesting era for him because he goes through a few different business ventures that some of them work out well, some of them don't. So one, he gets into boxing promotions. He has his friendship that starts off with Floyd Mayweather. If you remember the fight that they had in 2007, Floyd Mayweather versus Oscar De La Hoya, which at that point felt like one of the biggest boxing matches that we had seen in years. 50 Cent comes out to him. He sings that song Straight to the Bank, which I also believe is on the Curtis album, but he walks out with him there. And they then start the Money Team as their promotion company for boxing. But as many of us have probably seen, that relationship fell to the wayside. 50 Cent tried to start his own boxing venture, SMS, but it didn't quite take off. But 50 Cent did go into headphones as well with SMS audio and having his own headphones, but is also one that ended less desirably than he would have wanted to, just with some of the legal concerns there. And there's a few other ventures that we can get into, but there were a few years there where, all right, he's wealthy, he has his money from Vitamin Water, he's trying to figure out the next thing. And I think it just took a little bit of time to have that next thing work out for him.
Yeah, absolutely. And his expenses were pretty high. He bought that enormous house in Connecticut and in your old stomping grounds, right?
Farmington, Connecticut, not too far away from where I grew up. I drove by the house once, but you're bored and you're like, oh, let me go check it out. The place was huge and it was like a gate like right outside. And Farmington has a number of nice houses. He had no business paying as much money as he did to keep that thing up.
And it was something like $700,000 a year annually for upkeep. He bought it for $4 million. He listed it for $18 million and ended up selling it for $3 million, something like that. Now it's an old folks home. The biggest question I have about that place, 19 bedrooms, 35 bathrooms. What, like, why do you need 35 bathrooms? What's, is it, are you running like a sauna operation in there? But I think he started touring less. He started getting more involved in investing in illiquid things. And I think that was actually a big part of it. He had stakes in all of these privately held companies. And then he got hit with these two huge lawsuits, one of which was from a headphone related deal gone bad that resulted in an $18 million judgment against him. And then there was the thing with Rick Ross's ex and some multi-million dollar judgment. 50 got caught in the sort of liquidity crunch in the court filings that said that he had $25 million in assets against $35 million in debts. But, and people were saying, how could he have really made $100 million and blown through it all? And, but that $100 million is $50 million. And then he spent $10 million on upkeep on his house. He was also putting a lot of money into illiquid securities and into private investments. And I think part of his motivation was to protect some of his illiquid privately held assets that he couldn't necessarily be held against him in a bankruptcy court, and really just to get rid of some of these debts or to reduce them to more manageable amounts. I don't think that it was a good outcome for him. Obviously, nobody wants to declare bankruptcy, but I think in his view, it's just like all publicity is good publicity, right? It just kept him in the news, and he knew that he was going to go out and spin it into something else. Donald Trump, how many times did Donald Trump declare bankruptcy or have various bankruptcy proceedings against him? So I think that's how 50 approached it. And I don't think that it's really in the long term impacted him all that much.
It was obviously a lower point, but things really don't start to turn around until things really take off with Power, because this was even the early days of Power. Power starts in 2014, and it makes perfect sense. How do we take this semi-autobiographical nature of his life, bring it up with what's happening? And it was so timely because there was also this renaissance that was happening for Black culture-oriented entertainment, where Empire comes out around the same time, Insecure comes out a couple years later, Atlanta comes out a couple years later. So this is the moment. We saw this happen in waves over the years, where there was this big moment in the early 90s, like when Martin and Fresh Prince and the WB, there was less of it in the 2000s, maybe except for a show like Girlfriends. So you start to see this really take off. And then by 2016-17, Power's really having its moment where he signs what is a reported $150 million deal with Starz to continue developing more series and shows. That doesn't mean, oh, here is a $150 million check the same way that he gets equity in Vitamin Water's parent company, but it is something that provides him with enough stability. And now there's been over four different Power books, and despite some of 50 Cent's ongoing challenges and issues with Starz over the years, this has been a more successful non-music related venture that we've seen for someone like him. But he was able to do it with his broader multimedia projects he's been involved with over the past 8 to 10 years.
I remember when that news broke and people were coming to me, and at the time I was still at Forbes and the referee of hip hop wealth and all of that entertainment wealth. And everybody said, why is 50 Cent not on your list? He had a $150 million deal, so he's worth at least $150 million. I was like, no, he's not. Like, first of all, if you read the fine print, it's a three-series commitment. It includes a discretionary fund for use in developing G-Unit projects. Could be worth up to as much as $150 million, blah, blah, blah. Obviously, it was a huge deal, but I don't think we ever will really find out how much of the money made its way into 50's pockets. I'm sure he's making many millions of dollars a year off of it, right? So, huge deal, but not as big as some people perhaps make it out to be for him.
True. Agree with that. Also, don't want to underscore just how big it is to be able to have this series. And there's a few things with it that stick out to me. Parrot Analytics, which is this company that does analytics on media and entertainment shows, they have this stat that they call demand, which essentially looks at some viewership data that they can garner, plus some online mentions. And their estimation was that all of the power shows are responsible for 25% of the total demand that exists on Starz. Besides the Power Book shows and Outlander, those are really the shows that were carrying that network. So one, it works to his advantage because it allows 50 to play that underdog playbook, worked with these companies that may not be the Netflix, but they may be the one that's a couple rungs below. You can get a bit more influence, better economics in your favor. On the other hand, though, knowing the way that video streaming works today, if your show isn't on Netflix, it has considerably less reach, considerably less discussion. What would Power look like if it was on Netflix?
I also wonder if the bigger networks have some issue with 50. He's a controversial figure. Like, he'll say anything to get publicity, and I think maybe they don't want that headache. And whereas a place like Starz would be more willing to take a risk on something like that.
True. I could see that, because 50 Cent says some wild shit, and he called the show a shit show. He threatened to show early footage of seasons that were pre-released because he was frustrated. And who knows? It could have been some of this negotiation in public thing that I think that people can do oftentimes. But it makes me think back to some of the stuff that you and I talked about with our Adidas episode, and with how they felt dealing with Kanye, and how Nike may have felt as well, and some of the warning shots one way or the other, where I don't necessarily think that 50 was doing some of the stuff that Kanye West was doing in those Adidas meetings. However, no one wants to deal with that. It's a headache to be like, oh, like, did you see what 50 Cent just posted on Instagram about our senior vice president?
But I think the difference is it's more in control with 50. It's all part of a plan. And it wouldn't shock me if some of this stuff was actually deliberate and coordinated, right? There was this quote when he signed that deal where the head of Starz said something like, we're counting on 50 to create content for like within Starz and outside of Starz or something like that. And he could have been alluding to the music or whatever. Could he also have been alluding to brewing up like fake beefs and between the creators? That would be so 50, the ultimate Machiavellian type. I wouldn't put it past him. And I think that's what makes him a one of one. Like, you never really know. Is it all planned? It doesn't really feel planned, right? But maybe it is. And some of it is, for sure. And that's, I think, what has made him so successful over time. It's just that not knowing. Like, it is, it's whatever it is, it's believable. And that's why people tune in.
Right. And this is what he continues. The way that he talked about Empire and Fox and that show is the same playbook that he did talking about Murder, Inc. and Ja Rule and Ashanti and Irv Gotti.
And of course, now he still tours. Final Lap Tour grossed over $100 million, 20 different countries. I didn't see the tour, but I did see him. It was the 10-year anniversary of Get Rich or Die Trying at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. And he just played the whole album straight through in its entirety. And I got there and I was like, oh, this is amazing. He still has it. Look at the passion. But then, like, after a couple songs, once he got into, like, past the big hits and the energy of the crowd started dying down a little bit, you could tell that stoked to be there anymore. And he was, like, skipping words here and there and then cutting songs short. And it just reminded me of a time that I interviewed him. I said, what was a bigger deal to you, being out in front of a crowd and performing, or like actually getting a business deal done? And he said, and he didn't hesitate, he said, closing a deal is a bigger deal. And I think that really sums it up. He can go out there, he can perform, he can make music, but he doesn't have passion for it in the way that, say, Jay does. And although he's capable of making great music, especially when he teams up with the Dr. Dre, his focus is on the business. I wonder what would have happened if he and Dre hadn't drifted. And I know that they're like cool and all, but I think that 50 Cent trying to do his own headphone line, he admitted to me at some point that caused a bit of a rift for them, and it caused trouble with Interscope. And, you know, I think you don't have to always do your own thing, right? Like, sometimes it's better even for business to stay on a winning team, and then you can still have your own TV show and your own albums and video games and whatever. And so he is a bit of a lone wolf sometimes, and I wonder what his career would have looked like if he had been able to maintain that partnership to the level that it was.
Right. And there's like degrees to this, right? Because he obviously didn't sever ties the way that Game did, yeah. Where Game doesn't even get invited, yeah, to the Super Bowl that's to perform, right, on his own hometown, right? But on that note, before we close things out, anything else on Mr. Curtis Jackson?
In a funny way, he's almost Trumpy, right? He just says the most ridiculous shit with somebody who had more shame like it could be a problem for them, but it seems completely unhinged sometimes, but is actually often very calculated and it serves a purpose. There are a lot fewer negatives about 50 Cent than there are about Donald Trump, but a lot more positives about 50 Cent than there are about Donald Trump as well. They might be operating a little bit from the same playbook, a Machiavellian playbook. At 50, he can adapt to his surroundings and shapeshift in a way that Trump doesn't. But we're talking about one of ones. I think that ability to shapeshift and that ability to have authenticity even as you move around is what truly sets him apart and really does make him a one of one, 50 Cent.
50 being funny as well helped with a lot of this, right?
Yeah.
Like even some of the lines about like Ja Rule, sing for hoes, you sound like the Cookie Monster. Oh man, we could go on with hilarious 50 Cent things. But on that note, Zach, it's been a pleasure. Thank you. And out of respect to you, I will rewatch Get Rich or Die Tryin', the biopic, and see where I rank it in my rankings.
Maybe we'll do a live stream and watch it together. Some vitamin water.
Indeed. All right, thanks, man. Talk soon.
All right, Dan, take care.
If you enjoy this episode, please share it with a friend. Send it to one or two people you think would really get value out of listening to this episode. And while you're at it, if you could rate and review the show, that would be great. Rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts. Rate the podcast on Spotify. Rate the podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. That helps make sure that the word gets out about Trapital and what we're building here. Thanks again for listening. Talk to you next time.